Traditional just war criteria also demand that the initiation of war be undertaken by the proper authority. Under the U.S. Constitution, the proper authority is neither the President nor the United Nations. It is Congress. But Congress unconstitutionally delegated its decision-making power over war to the President. I had heard it argued that Saddam had indeed committed an act of aggression against the United States. He had shot at our airplanes. Those American planes were monitoring the no-fly zones over Iraq. Authority for such zones was said to come from UN Resolution 688, which instructs nations to contribute to humanitarian relief in the Kurdish and Shiite areas. The resolution actually says nothing about no-fly zones and nothing about bombing missions over Iraq. But Saddam Hussein missed every single airplane for 12 years as tens of thousands of sorties were being flown indicates the utter weakness of our enemy, an impoverished third world nation that lacked an air force, anti-aircraft weapons, and the navy. This was supposed to be the great threat, requiring urgent action. Such nonsense insults the intelligence of the American people and makes the rest of the world wonder about our sanity. And yet the propaganda continues even today. In one of the Republican presidential debates, after being called an isolationist, honestly, is the distinction between isolationism and non-interventionism really so difficult to grasp? I was solemnly informed that the course I recommended in Iraq amounted to the same kind of thinking that had led to Hitler. Now, all of us are used to hearing political propaganda, especially in presidential debates, but this really took the cake. Were the American people expected to believe that unless they supported the invasion and occupation of a completely paralyzed third world country, they were the sort of people who would have given aid and comfort to Hitler? Did this candidate really have such a low estimate of the intelligence of the American people? How, after all, had Hitler been able to rise to power in the first place? Hitler made a name for himself by denouncing the Treaty of Versailles, which established the peace terms with Germany at the end of World War I. Many observers at the time and since have described the treaty as severe and one-sided, and no, that is not how all post-war treaties are. After the Napoleonic Wars, the last continent-wide conflict until World War I, the Congress of Vienna imposed reasonable terms on defeated France and fully welcomed her back into the community of nations within only a few years. Hitler appealed directly to this sense of grievance on the part of the German people. How long, he asked, are we going to allow ourselves to be treated like a third-class nation? Now let us recall President Woodrow Wilson's decision to involve the United States in World War I. The level of popular support for Wilson's decision may perhaps be gauged by the massive propaganda campaign, without precedent in American history, that the government undertook to win over the public opinion. The war in Europe had been a stalemate prior to Wilson's intervention. Thanks to that intervention, not only did the Allies win, but they were also now in a position to impose the punitive Versailles Treaty on a defeated Germany. It is not at all a stretch to say, as many historians have indeed said, that Wilson's decision to intervene gave inadvertent impetus to Hitler's politics of extreme nationalism, since the treaty it made possible helped catapult him into the limelight. Hitler might otherwise have remained a nobody. German President Paul von Hindenburg was said to have sized him up as potentially a good postmaster general. Did Wilson intend this outcome? Did he intend to hand Hitler and his party a perfect strategy for their political advancement? Of course not. But here we are, faced once again with the unpredictability of foreign intervention and the strong possibility that by removing a bad government, we may wind up not with a better one, but a far worse one. Ever since then, no libertarian or traditional conservative I am aware of has had anything but contempt for the utopian Wilson. The mainstream left of his day was largely disillusioned by the outcome, having hoped for a more just peace and genuine progressives like Robert La Follette, Randolph Bourne, and Jane Addams had opposed the war from the beginning. That essentially leaves a smattering of neoconservatives today as Wilson's remaining defenders. But here was a historical lesson to learn, if there ever was one.